Up next, we have Joel Clement, who will be discussing socialism, labor, guaranteed wage, and the idea of non-reformist reforms. Joe?
Good morning. Worker control on the job is a demand radicals are bringing back into the labor movement. But what about the wage system as such? The industrial workers of the world like to say, instead of the conservative motto of a fair day's wage for a fair day's work, we must inscribe on our banner the revolutionary watchwords, abolition of the wage system. In that spirit, I'd like to turn to Peter Frese's reflections from his blog about the politics of work and why a universal basic income provides a needed critical lens for thinking through what is to be done. Frese begins by criticizing socialist economists Jason Shulman and David Schweikert for trying to predict exactly what socialism will look like. Frese contends that this would be, quote, foolhardy and moreover anti-democratic, since it preempts the actions and decisions of the actual masses who will have to make a post-capitalist world happen. So while these thought experiments about alternative economic models can be useful in clarifying our principles, I don't think we need to take the details all that seriously. Rather than trying to draw up a detailed blueprint of a socialist economy, I prefer to think in terms of what Andre Gorz called non-reformist reforms, changes to the system that can be implemented under capitalism, but which sets the stage for much further radical transformations. And I want to highlight one particular such reform that's associated with Gorz called the universal basic income. Frese finds the universal basic income compelling because it, quote, directly addresses one of the most fundamental objectionable things about capitalism, namely, the fact that almost everyone is dependent on performing wage labor in order to survive. What's so objectionable for Frese is that, quote, we live in a society that is more physically productive than any other that has ever existed. 80 years ago, John Maynard Keynes was predicting that the greatest problem his grandchildren would face was what to do with their abundant leisure time. Instead, we are all working more than ever. Frese points out that a UBI would give people the option of opting out of the labor market and effectively reduce the amount of unpleasant work people have to do, a concern that baffles him when it's missing from a planned socialist economy. This brings Frese to one of the things he found most unappealing about David Schweikert's vision. Quote, his description of economic life seems to assume that the ideal way to live is to have some job that you go off to for 40 hours a week for the rest of your life. If labor is unpleasant, the solution is to give workers more control, rather than giving them an option to opt out of work. Voice, rather than exit, to use Albert Hirschman's lovely phrase. Now, maybe this makes sense to some people who grew up in the mid-20th century, when the labor market was less volatile and careers were more stable, but it doesn't make any sense to me. Even if jobs for all is possible, why would it be desirable? If there's not enough work to go around, why would you go and create more? And maybe it's true that if we make the workplace democratic, then work will be fulfilling and people won't mind it. But in that case, why force them? It's at this point that you're supposed to start talking about material incentives, to take Schweikert's choice of jargon. It usually starts with some troll objecting that socialism is impossible because nobody will do any work without the fear of starvation. Then the socialist comes back with some argument about how socialism is actually going to motivate everyone to go out there and work hard. For Schweikert's system, the answer is that, quote, one's income is directly tied to the success of one's firm, end quote, and so you work hard for the material reward. But approaching the problem this way gets the whole issue backwards, by proposing solutions before we have understood what the actual problem is. If you just talk in general terms about giving people incentives to work, you're neglecting the reality that while some work would have to be done in any kind of desirable society, other kinds of work should actually be disincentivized. Broadly speaking, I'd say that paid work in capitalism falls into at least the following four categories. 1. Things that people want done, but which nobody particularly wants to do. 2. Things that people would do voluntarily provided they have enough time, even if they weren't paid. 3. Things that are useless or destructive and happen only because they facilitate capital accumulation and people's need for jobs. And 4. Things that people may want done and or may want to do, but which have destructive effects on other people or the environment. The discussions about material incentives are relevant to things in Category 1, but much of labor in modern capitalist societies falls into the other categories. I'd argue that a lot of artistic and knowledge work falls into Category 2, so does childcare, although just who does it voluntarily is another matter, which is why feminism is still a core part of socialist analysis. Financial engineering, telemarketing, and basically anything that happens in a private health insurance company falls into Category 3, and so does much of the estimated 25% of U.S. employment taken up by what economists call guard labor, which includes stuff like supervising workers, running the industrial prison complex, and providing private security, or just other stuff that's mostly about preserving current power relations and maintaining inequality rather than doing anything useful. And driving a car or burning coal for electricity might fall in Category 4. And even though I can sketch out examples like this, in general it's pretty hard to differentiate these different kinds of labor in capitalism. That's because capitalism creates a situation where all work is quote-unquote good, because it provides jobs, which people need in order to survive. However, these different kinds of labor wouldn't get differentiated in Schweikert's vision of market socialism either, since he still assumes that everyone is forced to work. Moreover, the idea of government as employer last resort implies that we'd be creating more useless Category 3 work for people. And some, Frase points out, advocate an alternative planning system that differentiates ahead of time between desirable and undesirable work. But such totalitarian planning isn't necessary, Frase argues, and makes things more bureaucratic than they need to be. We should start instead with making people less dependent on wage labor. Social services like public education and universal health care go part of the way, but to strike at the root of wage slavery, you need something like a universal basic income. And Frase anticipates the resistance, quote, with the critics screaming, but nobody would do any work. At one level, I think this is just silly. For one thing, at least in the short run, most people would want to make more than the guaranteed minimum, and so would continue to work. For another thing, it's clear that people do various jobs for a lot of different reasons that have nothing to do with money. And some kinds of work would get more popular if people didn't have to worry about having the money to meet their basic needs. Some jobs are really enjoyable, in other words, and people would do them for free if they could. Other kinds of work give the returns by conferring some kind of status. For example, for all but the most famous artists, making art is more about gaining recognition than making money. One appealing aspect of a basic income is that it would start to sort out the distinctions between the different kinds of labor I outlined above. If some jobs start being things people do as hobbies, then great. If some jobs disappear and we don't miss them, then great. And if you have to pay people more to make them take crappy jobs, that's great. However, in a world with a guaranteed income, it could very well turn out that there are some things that just aren't getting done. It's not clear that you'd be able to find enough people to clean office bathrooms or work the night shift at 7-Eleven if they had access to a basic income, no matter what you paid them. Some people invoke the above scenario as an argument against basic income, but let me emphasize, this is a problem I would love to have. Once it becomes clear what kind of work is both desired and undersupplied, we can have a proper political struggle about how that work will get done. Will it be by offering special rewards like Schweikert's material incentives, or will it be by creating some national service requirement in exchange for the basic income? Say, you have to go clean toilets or work the night shift at 7-Eleven once a month. Or will it be by finding clever new ways to automate these jobs, or by deciding that we can really do without some of these things we thought we needed? I can't predict in advance what the solution will be, and I don't have to. That's really the most important point I want to make here. I think the lesson of history is that momentous social change never happens because someone came up with a detailed plan for the future, won people over to it, and then implemented it. The chaos of real people making their own history always overwhelms such neat plans. If you just tuned in, I was reading from Peter Frase's blog post, Do They Owe Us a Living?, about universal basic income and the task of repoliticizing work. You can find a recording of this reading and a link to the blog post, which has a lot more links to David Schweikert and Jason Schulman's arguments, in a day or two by going to kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. For the Old Mole, I'm Joe Clement.